Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Veterans Day is still celebrated in other parts of the world as Armistice Day, which originally marked the cessation of the First World War. Most of what we read and see about that war is from battles on farm fields in places like France and Belgium. But the war actually started well to the east, and much of the fighting was fought in mountainous terrain in Austro-Hungary, Russia, and Poland.
It's in that region that Daniel Mason's latest novel is set during the First World War. The Winter Soldier tells the story of Lucius, a medical student in Austria whose studies are interrupted by the war, and he is pressed into service as the physician at a field hospital where suffering is frequent and plentiful.
Mason himself has a medical degree. In addition to his work as a novelist, he is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Stanford. He joined us on a recent trip to Milwaukee to see family and for an event at Boswell Book Company. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
So this book, from what I understand, was a very long time in the making. Where were you in life and in your other career when you first sat down either to plan it or start writing it?
So this was back in 2004, and I had just graduated from medical school. And it may have actually been in this waning days of medical school when I became interested in this period of time in the 1920s, when psychiatrists had become very interested in art produced by patients at mental asylums in Europe. And was interested in this from a psychiatric standpoint. At the time, I was thinking of becoming a psychiatrist, although I didn't know. And so I began to write a novel set during that period of time. And that book, that imagined book, never actually made it into the novel that just came out. But it did lead sort of bit by bit to the Winter Soldier, mainly in researching that story about a doctor. I was looking for a backstory and realized that any doctor at that period of time would have served during the First World War. And so it was while researching what it would have been like to serve in the First World War that I came across these anecdotes of how medical students with really no clinical training at all, very early on in their training, were conscripted into the army because the Austro-Hungarian army was so ill-prepared. And since I had just finished medical school myself, it was astounding to imagine that that someone in a similar position would suddenly find themselves with such responsibilities.
And I imagine your experience in medical school was somewhat different than what we read of the experience that Lucius has in medical school.
Right. So I think one of the wonderful things about writing fiction is you can really dramatize one's own experiences. And so a lot of what he experiences is a very heightened version of what I experienced. So he really is, when the book begins, he's chafing under the hierarchy and the formality of that educational system in which really one had virtually no interaction with patients whatsoever until very late in one's training. And this is not the case in medical school nowadays. You know, fortunately, patient care is brought in much earlier. And yet at the same time, I think for many medical students, we become students because we really want to be doctors. And you get there really excited, and then all of a sudden you arrive and realize you have 4 years before you even can begin the next stage of your training. And so there's an understandable excitement and impatience that comes at that stage.
There was not much thought given to issues like bedside manner in the 19 teens.
No. I think from a modern perspective, reading about the power differential between doctors and their patients at that time is pretty horrific. One sees photographs, reads accounts of these visits in which there'd be a senior attending physician followed by a huge number of trainees visiting a patient's bedside. That patient, of course, in a ward surrounded by other patients. So the concept that we have nowadays of privacy was something that really wasn't thought of. And really the patient is in these encounters an object to be examined and learned from rather than a person with their own experience of suffering.
There's a lot of suffering that takes place in the course of this book. And I guess I wonder how you reconciled writing that when your job in medicine is to alleviate it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. So in many ways, I see this as a coming-of-age story for a doctor. And when the story begins, Lucius is you know, my mind, someone with potential, but also a relatively shallow person who sees diseases as these physical things that happen to people's bodies without really thinking about the people whose bodies they are. And then as the story progresses, begins to recognize more and more the human side of suffering and eventually the impact that suffering has on families or even communities. But this is all a eye-opening experience for him. I mean, he hasn't encountered this before. And so along the way, he sees people in many stages of suffering. I think the hard part about writing about this is that I want to draw a reader in slowly into the experience. And at the same time, I think I'm a person who needs optimism and hopefulness. And so how do you fit those two aspects into the same book? The fact that people, that for a soldier wounded in the war, the experience is going to be horrific, and yet at the same time, it can't be 300 pages of that kind of horror. So in some ways, after a certain introductory period in the book where he sees some of these wounds in their fullness, hopefully a certain kind of lightness and hope begins to emerge, especially as the men in the hospital, the orderlies that he worked with and the soldiers that he take care of, find a certain kind of dark gallows humor, a certain sort of lightness amidst the fighting.
If I'm not mistaken, it was the First World War where what they called then shell shock and what we probably think of today as PTSD was really kind of recognized. How much were you able to put together of how shell shock was viewed in those days versus, you know, how we might approach it, or, you know, without giving away any patient confidences, you know, PTSD manifests itself in a lot of ways today. It must have been fascinating to look at, you know, sort of the earliest days of its understanding.
Right. It's a great question. I mean, one of the things I love about practicing psychiatry and one of the parts that makes it so interesting is that that suffering, mental suffering, manifests itself very differently depending on the cultural and social environment in which a person finds itself. And this is something that's particularly true of the symptoms that follow psychological trauma. And so you're right. In the 19th century, it's recognized that terrible experiences can have an effect on people. But the true magnitude is not appreciated, I think, until the First World War, when the armies find themselves utterly prepared for the epidemic of, you know, what we might call sort of neuropsychiatric illness that really breaks out on all sides of the fighting, so much so that in the first months of the war, the both sides send medical investigators to the fronts, to field hospitals, to try to figure out what's going on. Why is it all of a sudden that so many of our soldiers are reporting with this illness that we haven't identified before, certainly haven't seen in these kinds of numbers? I think that as a psychiatrist practicing today, one part of researching it that's both difficult but also was fascinating is that shell shock as experience had an incredibly diverse range of symptoms then. And so there were psychological symptoms that we might recognize today, like symptoms of depression or anxiety. But people also presented with a lot of physical and neurological symptoms that we do see today, but we don't see in epidemic form among active combatants in war. And yet, at that time, you had wards filled with people who weren't able to walk or had tremors or had amnesia or profound stutters, all secondary to the trauma. And so this is actually appears at a time when the first psychiatric film footage was taken just because of the history of film. And so it's actually possible to go back and look at some of these images from war archives on both sides and see presentations that look very different from the forms of psychological trauma that we see today.
There's a scene in this novel where there's a breakthrough with a patient, and we won't say too much more about it. But was that kind of experience? I don't want to say typical, but did you draw on real life examples where just essentially experimenting with a drug might have had such a profound effect?
Yeah. So in the in the book, there's a soldier who is given a drug that was either used for epilepsy or sometimes for anxiety then, but a drug called Veronal. Given this drug accidentally by Lucius and has this profound recovery. So this is a little bit of psychiatric trivia, I guess. This is something that we still see when people who have catatonic manifestations of psychiatric illness are given medications either of barbiturate or benzodiazepine class. They have sudden improvements. So not the case typically in PTSD or in shell shock then. So in the book, he actually has a little bit of a variant that would be somewhat atypical, but it's very striking. And I think that in psychiatry, recovery tends to be a somewhat slower process. It's not like getting an appendectomy, but it tends to be a slower process. And yet, catatonia is one area in psychiatry that can be treated quite quickly. The cause of the catatonia will usually take a longer treatment. In this book, that brings about its complexities because on one hand, miraculous cures, and that's what it looks like, are wonderful. But then at the same time, it's very easy, I think, to be seduced as a healer by that miracle. And that's essentially what happens in this book. He's remarkably proud, but perhaps a bit too proud.
Right. He's still sort of growing up in that area and understanding what healing really means.
Right. He's done something great. He's accidentally, but sort of systematically come across a way of treating this person. But then this other question of sort of what do you do next? And does that mean it was an accident, or does that mean that you have some profound gift? Of course, in this case, it was an accident, but he doesn't understand that. So it's in some ways his medical knowledge has outstripped a bit his practical sort of human knowledge.
I was thinking this as I read this book that you know, he's working with this nurse Margrets, and he's able to get the kind of physical, you know, the physical healing stuff fairly quickly, you know, sort of, and under fire and out of necessity. But it's this other part of growing up, this other part of becoming a doctor, that really takes much longer for him.
Right, right. So when he arrives, the other doctors have fled. One of them seems to have gone mad. All the nurses have died of in a typhus outbreak, yeah. And she's the only one who remains. And at first, especially as someone who's grown up in this deeply hierarchical system back in Vienna, he can't believe that a nurse could be carrying out this kind of medicine. But she's been there on the front lines, and she's learned to do the essential things that were necessary to take care of the common injuries that they saw. And when she realizes this, he realizes that she's going to be the one that's going to teach him this medicine. And so he begins to learn from her. And he develops, I wouldn't say a mastery, but he becomes reasonably effective at carrying out amputations, for instance, a very common procedure that they performed. But then beyond that, there's a whole group of other illnesses which he can't take care of, both physical ones. Like, for example, they wouldn't operate on abdominal wounds for the most part, which is really astounding when you think about it. But because of the lack of antibiotics and because of a lack of a sterile field, abdominal wounds had an incredibly high mortality, even compared to, for example, neurosurgical procedures. And so there's a more complicated medicine which he hasn't approached. But in the book, that the more complicated medicine really is the psychiatric wounds of the soldiers that are much more complicated than that, which he's prepared to treat.
This almost seems like a trivial question after this conversation, but I think a lot of people are sort of revisiting the First World War, you know, in this country and certainly in Europe. How hard was the geography and the minutiae of that war? It's such a complicated war. How hard was that for you to grasp and do justice to, if you will?
Sure. It's very complicated, and there's a lot of combatants, and the motives for fighting are difficult to parse out. It's a war which which historians have discussed endlessly in trying to figure out how exactly did this conflagration burst forth with such extraordinary violence so quickly and really take most of Europe into its fire. So it was difficult. Not only were there were the practical facts of history, but the theories about why this might be happening. For me, in writing about it, one of the more interesting parts is that I have always learned about the First World War really as a Western Front phenomenon. Those are the books that I read in high school, and the images of the barbed wire and the trenches are really burned into my mind. And I actually remember I would frequently dream of those images while working on this book. You know, this takes place in an entirely different front, on the front where the Austro-Hungarian armies fighting and German armies fighting against Russia, where it's a much more open landscape. There's much less entrenchment. Men are on horseback, and many of the armies are using not only modern warfare but more traditional kinds of warfare, lances, sabers, and so that was a completely different world than the world that I had imagined.
Right, and there are these alliances that exist, but they're not necessarily happy alliances.
Right. So also I think one of the great perhaps lessons of the war is that people came together quite uncomfortably. And so the Austro-Hungarian army itself was, even if they all were under the same command ultimately, because the empire was made up of such a diverse group of people, many, at least in the beginning part of the war, were there patriotically supporting Austria, although there's certainly plenty of exceptions. As the war goes on, that the reluctance for underrepresented groups like Poles or Czechs to be fighting this war for Austria became more and more apparent. And, you know, so much so that during the war there are groups that break away, but then especially after the war ends, so Armistice is going to be on November 11th, November 11th. That's in the West. In the East, fighting continues, and it's just the combatants change. But almost immediately, the different groups essentially turn on each other and new fronts open up, and fighting persists into the 1920s. There's no clear end in the same way that there might be an end in the West.
I gather from what you were telling me that a winter trip to Milwaukee helped shape the winter scenes, of which there are many in this novel.
Right, right. So it's wonderful to be here again because I'm from California. And so with any fiction, one uses the imagination to try to imagine what a setting would be like. But I think in California, we don't quite appreciate the winter in the same way we might. And so it was a few years ago, much of my wife's family from Wisconsin, and we were out visiting them in the middle of winter time. And I just found myself astounded by the expanse of snow and the bareness of the trees and the profound biting cold that maybe I felt as a Californian a bit more than natives might have. But that was a time when I was working in the book, and so a number of those scenes manifested themselves in the snow and in the forest of the Carpathians.
Speaking as someone who lived in Arizona for a time, but in the mountains, there is a difference between winter even in the mountains of the West and winter in Milwaukee. There's not the same kind of bleak aspect to Western winters, even where there is snow.
When I came here, I think what struck me the most as an outsider that winter was the palette. There were times where I was looking out on the scene, it was almost like walking into a black and white photograph. And I think that resonated with me in some ways because my interaction with the world of the Carpathians and the Eastern Front was through black and white photographs. So in a way, there was this quality almost of walking into this 100-year-old world of my book.
Well, you've done a remarkable job. Daniel Mason, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Right. Thanks so much for having me. And it's great to be here in the fall with all its colors.
Exactly. Hope we'll see you again.
All right. Thank you.
Daniel Mason's latest novel is called The Winter Soldier. Mason is also a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry and teaches medical humanities at Stanford University. We spoke with him during his recent trip to Milwaukee to see family and for an event at Boswell Book Company.